The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Our subject this morning, and this will be my final lecture, my subject this morning is suggestions for tomorrow's urban strategies. And I want to identify 15 high potential strategies that I see or foresee for the next decade. I don't dare predict anything beyond that because the world changes so rapidly. But here are some thoughts that I have put together that I want to challenge you with and have you think about. And I'll be interested in any further suggestions that you may have, the strategies that you think are going to be very important in the next decade or so. I think they're distributed, so let's begin. And I'm going to go right through the list and comment on each one. And if you have a question for clarification, feel free to raise your hand and we'll try to address it. The first strategy that I want to suggest that I think is very important has to do with the mass media evangelistic efforts that are being made around the world. And my suggestion is that we've got to work hard on coordinating mass media evangelism with church multiplication. You probably remember that circle I drew on the board earlier this week with the three sections to it. And in our work in Mexico City, we discovered, somewhat to our surprise really, that one-third of the people being drawn into the house churches were people whom we could classify as mass media inquirers. They were people that had been seriously interested in Christianity and evangelical faith through radio, literature, Bible distribution, but they had not been baptized, they had not made a decision, they were waiting for someone to knock on the door and deal with them personally. Now I think that we've got to encourage mass media missionaries and the agencies involved to do more, to use their work to promote, number one, converts affiliating with churches, and secondly, starting new churches. I think it can be done. I think we've got the potential in the media to multiply churches. We need correspondence courses that teach the basics of starting a church. We need radio and TV preachers speaking about the importance of the church, church membership, baptism, and in many cases starting churches where there aren't any now. I think that that is a major challenge area. Number two, I think that the strategies that will be effective in the next decade or more are those which focus heavily on the family, the oikos. Family in the broader sense of oikos now, not just nuclear family or not necessarily blood relatives, but the household, those who are networked together in meaningful close relationships and bonding. Now, we're dealing worldwide with a tremendous concern on people's parts as to what is happening to families. This is a topic being discussed throughout the world. And as we see the impact of urbanization, industrialization, secularism, and all kinds of things that are impinging on family life, families are breaking down, and people everywhere, Christians and non-Christians, are talking about it. This is a universal felt need. Now, the Bible lays a great stress on the family as a basic unit of society, basic to the church, basic to the covenant community. And I think that our strategies must take this into account, both the universal need and the strong biblical emphasis. I would also like to say a word about singles, because I believe this too is a universal urban phenomenon. So many singles in the cities. Now, I believe that singles need to be familied. What I mean is they have to belong to a group, a family relationship, an oikos, a household. And that is where the strategy of the house church, the cell, becomes so useful, because it promotes family-like covenant relationships, meaningful relationships. And I think this is a particularly urban need and suggestive of an urban strategy. Number three, the focus on the unreached peoples, and we've talked a lot about that this week, and that is where demographic research plays such an important role, and we'll talk about that more in a moment. But we must not neglect what I believe was one of the important emphases of the church growth school, and that is the emphasis on receptive peoples. Here we bow to the sovereignty of the Spirit, who, when he shows us how he has broken up the fallow soil and is putting cracks in the walls that have prevented people from believing and considering the gospel, then we have to move, because he is moving. And in a world of so much dislocation, refugees, migrations, the migrations of our time are greater in number than probably ever before in world history, and I think that God is behind this, and he is opening up receptivity in some remarkable places, which we must take into account as we develop our strategies. Number four.
Dr. Greenwood?
Yes.
Excuse me. On that point, like a lot of times, a particular group is unreached. You don't know in the beginning whether they're receptive or not.
That's right.
Where do you draw the priority?
Well, that's a question that has often been asked of the church growth people, and I think their answer is correct, that you have to have the missionaries in place everywhere, among the receptive and the non-receptive, in the fast-growing fields and those that are resistant. However, where you see receptivity in great measure, I think that the strategy of the Spirit would say to us, go in there with added force, with added effort. And I don't like to see that lost with the new emphasis now on unreached, which it would suggest that all are equal as far as strategic effort would be concerned. And I think we have to take both into consideration. Okay. Number four, targeting youth and children. Earlier this week, we talked about the fact that we are rapidly seeing the youthfulness of the world, as by the end of this century, half of the world or more will be under 21 years of age. With 3.5 billion babies born, live births, between 1980 and 2000. Now, I believe that this is one of the most awesome facts to be dealt with in strategy planning. And it calls for new approaches, perhaps new organizations, particularly designed and committed to youth work, new programs, new strategies to reach, as some have called them, the small half of the world. I'm impressed by YWAM's commitment to reaching young people. Most of you are acquainted with YWAM, Youth with a Mission, a somewhat charismatic mission organization, a young organization, which now, by the way, if my information is correct, is the largest mission-sending agency in the world. It has passed the Wycliffe Bible translators in the number of people they put on the field. YWAM is an interesting organization, not very well known. They don't make a lot of noise about themselves in the churches, but they are very committed to cities and to children. And they are doing some very interesting things. That's one of those to watch, I think. Now, throughout this week, we've heard a number of you say that college and university age young people are among the most responsive to missionary effort. I hope, and we all hope and pray, that this is a sign of God shaking things loose and beginning to move, and that the forces that have prevented young people from staying with the church after they finish their school years, that those forces will be mitigated, and that the faith, the seed planted, will continue. Number five, I believe that the strategies we design and implement in the next decade or so have got to be even more holistic than we have been in the past. We've got to keep word and deed together, both in our personal ministries, our individual style of carrying out mission work, and in the overall programming and administration. And when I say administration, I am thinking of the fact that in many cases we have divided the kind of mission organization that focuses on development work and relief from mission organizations that are particularly designed for core evangelism, you know what I mean? Word and proclamation evangelism. Now, I think we've got to draw those together more than we have in the past. I think the world conditions and people's expectations require that we do. We live in a time in which high on the world's agenda are issues of poverty, justice, and redistribution of the world's goods. And we've got to be very sensitive to that, both in our personal lifestyles, our ministry styles, and in our organizational strategies. I think that if there ever was a time when we've got to be taking seriously both word and deed and a holistic approach, it's right now. I want to suggest a book. It's written by my colleague Harvey Kahn. It's a very interesting little book. It's easy to read. It draws a lot of illustrations from Asia. It's Harvey Kahn's book, Evangelism, Doing Justice and Preaching Grace. And the main thrust of that book is exactly what I've been talking about. The blending together of concern for body and soul, justice and saving grace. And it's a plea for holistic missionary strategy in a very winsome way with a lot of illustrations. He was a missionary to Korea for many years. Number six, Baker Bookhouse came out 2 or 3 years ago, I think about 82. Number six, I want to suggest that the multiplication of house churches and cells is probably the most universal, effective missionary strategy in the world today. And I think we're going to see it multiply in both its attractiveness and effectiveness, because we live in a world of broken relationships. The cities are filled with lonely people, people whose needs can only be met through small group and interpersonal relationships. And when those are wound together with the love of God and the message of Jesus Christ, we have a basic strategy that is very important. It's so highly adaptable, you know. You can establish, even within one missionary's ministry, small group Bible studies and cell groups in different social classes. You can have one among workers, you can have another among students, you can have one among upper class elite. It's so adaptable, so flexible. And I think it's something that must be in every missionary's toolkit, how to establish these. I say to students back in Philadelphia that if you're thinking about evangelism or missionary service anywhere, get the kind of training that will equip you to be able to form and lead and maintain small group Bible studies. This has just got to be in your toolkit. How to do that, the dynamics of a small group and the leadership, how to start them, how to keep them going, how to develop them in certain ways. This is very essential. And the beauty of it is, of course, that this kind of cell multiplication works even when governments are hostile and when there's tyranny and oppression, as you have in some Asian countries and in Muslim countries. How do you form a shape in a Muslim country? How do you form a church? How do you shape the church? You have to do it in some sort of small group, perhaps an underground church unit. And these are the kind of strategies we've got to be developing, experimenting with, and working. Number seven. Well, this addresses the fact that in our cities we have so many churches that have been there for some years, some of them for a long time, but they are evangelistically relatively sterile. They're not producing. They're not giving birth to new congregations. And I would suggest that both within denominational missions and parachurch missions, we've got to be speaking a word to such churches about establishing daughter churches. We need to be addressing a word to pastors and church leaders about the fact that cities are growing, new peoples are moving in, and unless the established churches are willing to undertake this challenge of multiplying churches in the new neighborhoods, in the new barrios, in the apartment houses, why, mission organizations can't do it alone, and vast numbers of people in the cities aren't going to be reached. He's dead now, but there was in Mexico City a great old gentleman by the name of Dr. Moses Lopez. And he was a medical doctor and a lay preacher and a very good speaker. He had a lot of invitations in Presbyterian churches to speak at the Sunday services. Now, Dr. Lopez's medical qualifications were somewhat suspect. He was a bit of a quack, but he did some remarkable things with those strange little pills and ointments that he mixed together, and it seemed that the mother-in-law of one of the past presidents was incurably ill and had gone to every high-priced doctor in Mexico and the United States, and no one could cure her, and someone had directed her to Dr. Lopez and his strange little medical office, and he'd concocted something that cured the woman. I think it was his prayers more than his mixtures. But anyway, he was immediately given an honorary doctorate and a number of other gratuities, and became rather famous. And it didn't hurt his witness either, because he remained very evangelical and very strong for the Lord through it all. But what I'm leading up to is this: that he had a great desire to multiply churches in this growing city. And in the course of his life, he probably started 36 churches. Now, he didn't do a great deal beyond getting them started. This was his method. He would be invited to preach in churches, established churches, churches like the kind I was describing, that hadn't done a whole lot in evangelism, certainly not giving birth to any daughter churches for a long, long time. And his message was always an evangelistic challenge. And he would give kind of an altar call at the end, Presbyterian style, in which he would challenge the members to do two things: open their homes for Bible studies with a view to starting a church in your area, because these church members, and especially the older churches, were scattered throughout the area. They weren't all living right around the church. And so he'd say, "I'll dare say there's no church within walking distance of where you live. Have you considered opening your home for a Bible study and praying that your neighbors will come to Christ and start a church in your part of town?" And then the second invitation was for people to help him with the ones he already was getting started, because he was a catalyst. He was a number one type leader, getting things started all the time. But he himself never stayed involved very long. He always agreed to attend the first service, and he would stay with it for a little while. But that second invitation he gave was very important, because he was getting a lot of responses. People listened to him, and the Lord stirred people to respond. And he was getting a lot of things going, and he needed a lot of volunteers to man these places and to keep them going. And he was very successful. Remarkable little gentleman. And I even took one of his mixtures one time. Didn't do me any good, but Number eight. The promotion of networks in the cities, between cities, between similar ministries in different locations. I think we've done a lot of that here this week. We've been networking East Asia and the SEND and OMF related urban ministries. Now this is important, and I hope that with some of the ideas that we've been germinating this week, we will go back to our cities and we will work quietly at networking between those who are involved in urban ministries. Remember, our greatest resources are the people resources, God's people who are working with us in these areas and from whom we can draw their help, their gifts. We can't do it all alone. And I should think that here we've got to be crossing denominational lines. This is an area where the churches and the parachurch missions need to work closely together. And whenever I work with denominational third world churches and their leaders, I keep pushing this. Cooperate with the parachurch missions. You need them. They need you. We can't do it alone. Now, I think this is a message we've got to get across all the way through. Let's not duplicate efforts unnecessarily, but let's draw from one another's resources and gifts. Number nine. I think we've got to work hard experimenting and creating some new methods of how to encounter people with the gospel. The case study we saw last night based on Japan mentioned that the key problem was communicating effectively to Japanese people the message of the gospel. How do you get to them when they don't seem interested? How do you present the message contextually, effectively, in a way that communicates when there are so many barriers? Now, this is a problem we have everywhere in greater or lesser degree. And I think that the discussion we had about different places of encounter is one of the areas we've got to work at. Where do you encounter people? Make that initial contact. Begin to communicate Christ to them. Now, let me tell you about a survey done a few years ago in Santiago, Chile. Now, this is the kind of thing I would suggest maybe you consider trying out. It's sort of a poor man's research project. But Paul Prettis did this. He's with Latin America Mission, one of their veterans, and has worked for years. By the way, Paul has now been assigned by Latin America Mission to set up a research and strategy headquarters in Mexico City. I think this will be the first mission to do this. And it will be doing research on that 18 million population and sharing information with missions and churches that want to get involved in church planting. Well, Paul Prettis and some of his colleagues did a little survey in Santiago. And this was the question. Very simple question. If a friend, now this question was always asked to non-believers. If a friend invited you to an evangelical service in his church, in his home, or in a stadium, would you go? I'll repeat that. If a friend invited you to an evangelical service in his home, in his church, or in a stadium, would you go? Well, this is what the survey showed up. The upper classes, 90% said yes in his home, 0 in his church. The lower classes, 90% yes in his church, 10% yes in his home. Now, there are various reasons for that. I think the lower classes in Santiago knew something about Protestant churches, and there was a general acceptance of them that it was an okay place to enter. The upper classes didn't feel that way. More traditionally Catholic and suspicious of this foreign religion. As to the size of the homes, the upper classes had homes that were very commodious, and inviting guests to their home was something they were accustomed to doing. Among the poorer classes, homes were crowded, poor, sometimes embarrassing, and people were reluctant. But at least at that time in Santiago, this was a rather startling difference. And by the way, the middle class was in between, about 50-50. And the middle class showed much more interest in stadiums. Now, other things that that survey indicated was that a major factor in all classes was that someone accompany them on the first occasion of the visit. A major factor in all classes, upper, middle, and lower, was that someone accompany them on the first occasion, on the first visit, that they be accompanied by a member, by a Christian. And this, I think, was revealing. Along with the personal invitation, which is always such a powerful thing, comes the personal accompaniment. You don't just say, come to my church, I'll come and pick you up and we'll go together, or to the stadium, or to that home service, or that evangelistic breakfast, or whatever it may be. Personal accompaniment, picking the person up and giving that new person a sense of relationship, and not being a stranger coming through the door and wondering what you're going to meet with. Paul Pretis, LAM, Santiago, Chile. Pretis is Pretiz. Stadiums seemed to appeal to middle and lower classes if there was no admission charge. And the higher percentage said they would consider going to a stadium alone, unaccompanied by a Christian friend. But to the home or to the church seemed to require being accompanied. Now, we talked this week about different places of evangelistic encounter. We talked about hotels and restaurants, and some of you have shared with me some fascinating ideas that are being worked on and carried out, hotel evangelism and so forth. Now, I think we've got to experiment a lot more with that kind of thing. And if you are working with the upper classes, I'll give you this illustration. In Philadelphia, where I live, there is a family, the DeMoss family, a very wealthy family. Arthur DeMoss is now dead. His widow, Nancy, continues to live there and carry on a ministry which her late husband had started. Now, they have an enormous home, and they have the wealth that can provide for very gracious hospitality and elaborate meals. And Arthur DeMoss would use his home as an evangelistic encounter point. And he would invite to dinners at his home wealthy people from all over, business people and others that he would meet with in the course of his business. And what he would do is he would invite some personality, a Christian, and fly that person in from anywhere to be the special guest at the dinner at his home. And I've known of him flying people from London and other parts of the world just to be there, and then that would be the occasion. It would be his wife's birthday or his son's birthday or his birthday. He'd invent all kinds of reasons for the occasion. And then he'd fly somebody in, and then he'd invite these non-Christians, the elite of society, millionaires, to his home for this dinner, for this celebration. And of course, the special guest would be allowed to, or invited to say something, and the message would come across very subtly, with a lot of finesse, but very effectively. And the man has led so many people to the Lord from a circle of society where most of us find it very difficult to penetrate. Well, it's an idea, it's creative. It's opening some doors that previously were very tight closed. Number 10, the utilization of unpaid, gifted, lay persons. What I'm really calling for here is a far greater emphasis on the training, equipping, motivating of lay people, men and women. The churches have so many untapped resources. people with gifts, talents that God has given them, that are not being utilized to the fullest. And let's face it, you know it's true in the countries we work in, there's a lot of clericalism still around. Forms of sacerdotalism left over from the Middle Ages we haven't gotten rid of. Clergy-run churches and the idea that missions, evangelism, ministry is for the clergy alone. Now, I think that the strategies we've got to develop will break through the clericalism. And we just need to emphasize the kind of training programs many lay people are looking for and will respond to. And through it, all kinds of new resources for evangelism are going to be tapped. The gifts that are required for the work God wants are there. We believe that. Our job is to identify them, cut them loose, send them out, and strengthen them as a minister. And again, we've got to do some new things. The world is just too big, the challenges are too many, and we're too small to just keep going around in our same patterns. I'm thinking, for example, of this remarkable trip through China, I think it was last year, of this group of Christian artists. Did you hear about that? Some top-notch Christian artists. And by the way, if there's any artists here, there are several associations of Christian artists. One of them got together, and you see what's happening in China today is after years when under the Cultural Revolution, the art of the West, all Western art was forbidden, and those who taught it were gone. Today there's a tremendous interest in Western art. And this Christian Artist Association was invited to China as the guests of the government. I believe they paid their tickets up to Hong Kong. And from there, they were the guests of the Chinese government. They spent 3 months touring China, displaying their arts. They took all their paintings, they had all kinds of baggage, and they took it all in, and then they lectured explaining Western art, but they were completely free to witness for Jesus Christ, explain a Christian approach to art, and to bear witness of their Lord. These were laymen, laywomen, using the gifts outside of the stuff seminaries are all about, using this as the jumping off point for a tremendous witness. They reached Chinese university students that you and I would never be able to touch. Now that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Again, I find the YWAM organization very creative. Have any of you seen their drama groups? I've seen them in Europe, and they are top notch. And they can get in and capture an audience because of the very quality of their drama performances. And they weave in beautifully Christian values, a Christian witness, and zap, they've got that audience before they got their guard up. Very interesting. And another group that's doing some very creative work are the Messianic Jews. The Jews for Jesus organization, for example, is doing some very rare stuff. Do you know what their ads cost? I just saw this recently. It was published. You know, at Christmas time, they do these full-page ads in Newsweek, Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal. You know what their latest set of ads cost them? One shot, 1 week? About $1 million. I think it was $900,000. Out of that, they work for months just handling the follow-up mail. And they are as computerized, Mike, you'd be so proud. They are computerized as up to snuff as any mission organization could ever be. I've been in their headquarters in San Francisco, and it's like NASA. I mean, it's really up to the latest. And highly gifted, skilled Jewish believers in Yeshua. And God is using them. And they're doing creative things that most of us just haven't thought of doing. And if you've seen their tracts and some of their literature, it's different than any of the evangelistic literature we generally use. But the people on their staff are just the top people. Interesting. Well, we live in exciting times, and I really believe that God is gifting His people out there. We've just got to be open and looking and recruiting the gifted people He makes available. And by the way, I've always been so impressed by lay people's willingness to sacrifice, spend their own money, and just go the second mile when they're given a big enough challenge. Let's keep that in mind. We're never going to have enough money in the West to do all the things that I think we're being challenged to do, but there are untapped resources we've got to find. Number 11. The targeting of the urban masses, the new urbanites in the great cities. A thumbnail rule that I have learned to follow is this: wherever you find people going through significant change, the kind of change that puts pressure on them, shakes them loose, puts in a certain amount of insecurity in their lives, you find a people receptive to new ideas, including the gospel. These would be new urbanites, refugees, peasant folk who are now in urban communities, and almost every city has them. Now, we can't depend on the existing churches to reach these folks. And that's where missionary organizations have to play a special role. Many of our cities have lots of churches, but they are socially ingrained. They are not at this point ready to reach the refugees, the immigrants, the most receptive people very often. And this is where we have to both address our word of exhortation to the churches and find our own mandate and strategy as we say, what is God calling us to do as expatriate missionaries in this situation? Number 12. Encourage and cooperate with the new wave of third world mission organizations. Now, a couple of years ago, my wife and I taught for a month in Seoul at a Presbyterian mission training school called Missionary MIT. Mission, I can't remember the name for it now. Missionary Training Institute is what it was. And it was run by the General Assembly of Presbyterians as a training school for Korean missionaries going overseas cross-culturally. Now, we all know that Koreans have been going abroad for a long time. They're all over the world. And they've sent out a lot of pastors to minister to Koreans overseas. Now they're taking the next step and are going cross-culturally. Maybe some of them are working in countries where, in fact, I think some of them are in Thailand. Others are going to Taiwan, to Thailand, they're going to India. In some cases, they can get visas where many of us from the West cannot. I think this is a very interesting new development. When countries like the ones where we're working in are now sending out missionaries. I know the Japanese churches have sent out some. Maybe some have come from Taiwan and other countries. Many Latin American countries are now sending out missionaries to other Latin American countries, some to Spain and Brazil. And this, of course, is what we want, and we praise God for it. And we want to see all parts of Christ's body participating in the global mission of the church. Now, I think we've got to cooperate and encourage, and in whatever way we can, assist them. In the Missionary Training Institute that my wife and I were teaching in, they were using
veteran missionaries to teach certain courses because they realized there were some things we could help them with. They weren't entirely dependent on foreign missionaries at all, but they were using some of us for special courses. And I think these mission agencies are going to face special problems. In the case of the Koreans, for example, they've got to learn both English and then a third language, and that's going to be true in many instances. They're going to have to learn the third language via English, which isn't going to be easy. In some cases, they have a harder time getting a visa than an American would. That's another problem. But this is a new wave. God is bringing to the surface new missionary resources, and I think it's very exciting. Wherever we can assist them, I think we should. It's also going to help us, I think, communicate and relate to the churches overseas. Because now the missionary experience, the problems, the frustrations, the mistakes, are going to be things that they experience too. And they're going to be better able to understand us, and we're going to be, I think, find it easier to relate to them when they now have to face the things that we know very well and sometimes haven't been able to communicate effectively with national churches. Number 13. This has to do with the new grassroots churches, sometimes called autochthonous churches. That is, they're this new breed of churches that are not the direct result of overseas mission efforts. They're not related to traditional groups, denominations, theological traditions, but are churches of the soil. The independent churches of Africa, many of the Pentecostal churches of Latin America, and you will have them in your countries as well. Churches that very often are growing rapidly. They've got their own brand of leadership, certain twists in their theology perhaps, and they do things differently, and they run their own ship. These are these grassroots churches that are springing up and very often doing very significant things. Interestingly, the black churches of North American cities, by and large, represent this same kind of phenomenon, the grassroots churches. In Philadelphia, the largest Protestant church is Deliverance Evangelistic Church, three blocks from our home on Broad Street. It was started about 25 years ago by a pastor by the name of Benjamin Smith, a pastor. He had no training. The Lord just laid his hand on him, and Benjamin Smith started in a living room with, I believe, eight people. Today, his church has 7,000 members. It's a very active church, highly organized, great staff, pastors and ministers in all kinds of divisions. It's a highly organized church. They have a fine Bible Institute and doing great things. But they don't belong to anybody's tradition, denomination, or whatever. They do their thing, and they do it very well. Manuel de Melo's church in Sao Paulo, Brazil. I spoke of it earlier. Thousands and thousands of members. How many today? 50,000? I don't know. But it's mammoth. The auditorium has a capacity of 30,000. And spread all over Brazil. Manoela de Mello is his own denomination. Doesn't belong to any particular tradition. And you can name any number of similar grassroots kind of churches. And some of the most significant church growth is in that area. Now, what does that relate? How does that relate to us? And how do we relate to it? Well, let me tell you something. They're not easy to relate to. They don't necessarily want any help and don't need it. And if we're going to have any role to play in their life, it's going to have to be on their terms, on their turf, on their schedule. But recently I talked with some people from the Latin America mission, and they have decided to regard ministry to and through these grassroots churches as one of their major agenda items for the next 10, 20 years. They are going to make missionaries available to the grassroots groups on the terms that the nationals want to set for ministries what those churches feel they need. Many times it's going to be in Bible institutes and teaching. And their feeling is that these groups probably are going to experience the greatest proportion of numerical growth in the closing decades of the 20th century. Not the traditional denominations, not even the faith missions with our usual programs and strategies, but this new breed of autochthonous churches, the grassroots kind, which sometimes we're going to have to swallow hard because there are certain practices and teachings we don't entirely agree with, and everything's going to have to be on their terms. We're going to have to exercise a servant style of ministry in everything. But if we want to put our efforts into something that's going to make a tremendous impact, here's a field. An illustration of this is a man by the name of Sam Olson. Where he got such a North American name, I don't know, but he's a Venezuelan. And Sam Olson, I believe, was Presbyterian before he went off to school and got some new ideas and came back to Venezuela and didn't feel comfortable in any of the churches. No, pardon me, he was Assemblies of God. That's remarkable because they are doing a lot of great things in Latin America. But he went to the United States, he came back and decided to start his own church. That's the grassroots type. And his church is now the biggest in Caracas, Venezuela. Thousands of members. The church campus, and I call it a campus because it's far more than just an auditorium. It's a square block in the heart of the city. An enormous layout. Every kind of ministry you can imagine. And it's entirely independent from all denominations. Paul Cho, Youngji Cho, in Korea is much the same. Somewhat related, I believe, to the Assemblies of God, but grassroots, doing his thing, carving out his own church. Now, I want us to consider as one of the strategies for the next 10 years, making available to such churches, if they so desire, missionary resources on their terms, accepting their leadership, which can make a qualitative difference in the development of those groups. I think the older churches of the West that we represent have things to offer them, things they need. They have much to teach us. I think we should not ignore them, but should build lines of relationship with them. Number 14. I guess you could expect this one after yesterday. I think we should invest in and utilize urban and demographic research. These new social sciences can help us. We should not neglect them. God has provided them to us, and we should utilize them. They can help us avoid mistakes, keep us from overlooking certain peoples and movements. They can help us shape our strategy, and in so doing, make us more effective and save us money in the process. Now, it's going to cost us something. People with real expertise and advanced study in demographics, and I'm not one of them. I'm a layman in that field, trying to learn, read, do it. But there are people with expertise. People that have graduate studies in this area. And the Southern Baptists, for one, are hiring those kind of people. And they're investing with the long-range strategy in mind of having the data available for the missionaries to use. And you probably have heard they've got this going on in about 100 major cities around the world, and they hope to add another 100 after that. Now, I think that's important. A friend of mine, Timothy Munsma, is opening an institute for urban research in Pasadena, California. And he's just finished a study of about a dozen major cities of Africa. He's going to go on after that. And that will be on computer and will be available to mission organizations like yours to tap from. I think it's something we've got a budget for, plan for, and be willing to invest in. Number 15 and the last one. We need to keep growing in our theological understanding of the cities. Because after all, mission is motivated by, informed by, enlarged by a growing theological insight. The kind of meditations we've had, the opening of each morning session this week, have helped us. And we've got to be reading our Bibles with urban eyes. The Bible is filled with examples of urban ministries, insights we haven't seen before in our rural past. And through this, we've got to be helping city pastors preach sermons that are filled with helpful insights for city people. In other words, we've got to be sensitizing Christians to see their urban mission from the Word of God, theologically defined, explored, and from that we will be preparing a whole new breed of urban Christians. People who will be ready to move out to the streets from the doors of our churches, motivated, enlightened, with a vision of what it means to labor for God in an urban world. You know, something's been coming through to me this week as we've been working together here of what it must have been for Abraham, whom God called out of a very urbanized part of the world of his day. Ur was a metropolitan center, a place of culture, art, rather advanced civilization for that period in history. God called Abraham out of it to become a wanderer. A wanderer who lived in tents and kept moving on because he had a calling and he had a vision. And the writer of the book of Hebrews reflects theologically on the Abrahamic journey from a city and ultimately to a city while he lived in tents along the way. And I think what we see in Hebrews 11, and then it's applied to Jesus Christ, who is the one to whom we've come, the city of the living God. And then the 13th chapter, the reminder that we have here no enduring city, but we are looking for the city that is to come. I think we, in our time and in our urban ministries, repeat the Abraham experience. Abraham, who in the course of his journeyings must have encountered many cities and towns, and each time he looked for the thing he had hoped for and didn't find it, and disappointed, returned to his tents. And you and I live in the midst of the cities of this world with a high degree of disappointment, frustration, a longing for that which is yet to come. Because, you see, we have the Abraham vision. We're looking for something that isn't here yet. And that always keeps us in a kind of tension between what is here and now and what we know is yet to be. And that is the context of our life and our ministry. I think there's so much in the Bible that is going to inform us, instruct us, motivate us as we delve into it. We've tasted it this week. Better things yet lie ahead. And as we were reminded this morning, we're all on our way to a city. As we pass through the cities below, we have the vision of Abraham on the city God's made, who whose builder and maker is our Lord. So thank you very much.